Jay Mallard, host of The Mallard Report. On The Mallard Report, along with my guest, we will have a conversation where we will share thoughts and opinions. For more information, my bio, past shows, social media links, and so much more, visit mallard.com. MALLIARD.com. And thanks for listening. First, I want to welcome Natalie Schilling to the program, professor of linguistics at Georgetown University. I'm glad I have smart people on because I can't seem to find my talking voice tonight. I guess it's a video, the English in America, the linguistic history. Is that a video, or how is that, Natalie?
Yeah. Oh, hi. It's nice to be on your program. Thanks for having me. I have an audio-video course with the great courses called English in America, a Linguistic History.
Perfect. And the other gentleman on the line, familiar to many of you around here, is James Fitzgerald, or as he'll be referred to as throughout the rest of this interview, as Fitz, the author of A Journey to the Center of the Mind, former FBI profiler, most notably known for the Unabomber. How are you doing tonight, Fitz?
I'm doing fine, Jim. Thanks, too, for having me back on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. I like having you on. You just make me sound so good. But this next word, I'm going to skip it. You're going to have to explain it to me and give me the exolinguistics. I totally butchered it, didn't I?
Maybe we should first give them a lesson how to pronounce linguistics.
Yeah, I was going to say, bring me up to speed on how to pronounce it first, and then...
Okay, so it's called linguistics, and what that is the scientific study of language. And that's what I specialize in at Georgetown University. Those are the courses I teach, linguistics courses about language structures, language use, issues such as cross-cultural communication, things such as this. And Jim mentioned that perhaps your listeners would be interested in a subfield of linguistics that's called xenolinguistics, which has to do with alien languages.
Say that one more time. Xeno?
Xeno, X-E-N-O, linguistics.
Yeah.
It's xenophobia same prefix. And so there is a sub-branch of linguistics that considers, okay, well, if humans come into contact with aliens at some point, what type of form could their language have? And could humans actually communicate with them?
That's just mind-blowing. I mean, I talk a lot about paranormal, UFOs, all that fun stuff. But I guess I have never... I've jokingly said I'd go run and jump on the UFO just because... But I guess I never really fought through it enough to say, well, how would I communicate with them once I got on the ship and not get myself killed? So where's the root of this at? I mean, I can understand the root of our languages that we know, but how did this even come up?
I mean, obviously there's a lot of speculation, but if you think about, oh my gosh, science fiction movie series. So if you remember, of course, we all know Star Trek, and they had their communicators that enabled them to somehow mysteriously communicate with, anybody, any creature of any race, even though they were all speakers of, English, American English, that sort of thing. Klingon that's also very interesting. An invented alien language is actually now an entire language, even though it was invented, obviously not from real Klingons, but invented by humans. So that's the subfield of xenolinguistics. If they're, if humans encounter aliens at some point, what would they talk like? If we're making a TV show or a movie or a series that includes aliens, what is their language like? So what do we do to make it, to invent a language for aliens?
And Jim, when you think about it, it's only been about 600 years, give or take, that, Spaniards and Italians were, sailing across the Atlantic for the first time, and they came upon the indigenous peoples in the Americas. And granted, we're all humans, and we all speak, through our, mouth and verbal you know, noises and sounds which represent meaning. But, you know, somewhere down the line, somebody had to come up with a translator, an interpreter, to figure out how could the Spaniards talk to, you know, the Incas or the Aztecs, whatever, or the Native Americans, you know, Cherokees or Arapaho. But they eventually did. And I know we talked about the movie Arrival, and here the aliens that come to Earth are not even speaking, or I should say not even communicating in a spoken language, but more one that's character or symbol-based, that's very temporal. And that added a whole different challenge to the Louise Banks character, who was the linguist protagonist in that movie. So we have our own similarities here on Earth, but of course, communicating someday, we'll assume, with people from other, with creatures, with entities from other worlds, will be a whole new challenge that probably no one here is really prepared for quite yet.
Well, we've got our Space Force coming, though, so, I mean, oh boy, that just sounded like a loaded point when I made it. But that makes it seem more of a reality, even more so than like when we first talked about doing this interview. If we're talking about protecting space, I mean, that kind of tells, maybe I'm just being biased, but maybe it tells me, I know there's weapons and stuff, but maybe we're protecting from the outs, you know, from the inside out, too. Reading too much into it.
Yeah, I mean, we can go there if you want. I mean, to me, it looks like, you know, we have more space exploration we want to do and open up the rest of the solar system, Mars. I never want to be the guy that 50 years from now they play back this recording. Oh, this guy Fitz said there's no life in our solar system. Well, there may be. I don't know. But certainly none found so far, and none that too many linguists are concerned with being able to communicate with from our own solar system. But again, we never know if we do have travelers that come by a whole different dimension, different means, if in fact that would happen. And part of me would like to think that if they have the technology to come as far to Earth, that somehow they would maybe have studied our language in advance and could somehow speak an Earth language to us instead of us having to look at, like, almost, they weren't smoke signals in the movie Arrival, but certainly, you know, symbols that were very temporal that sort of disappeared after a minute or so, and the whole time-space continuum issue was brought into that. So all I would say is, as a linguist, and I'm a linguist too, in fact, Natalie was one of my professors at Georgetown University. That's how we first met. And, you know, we have to be open-minded about any language we don't understand. There are no bad languages out there. It's just, or dialects, it's just trying to learn from the person and find a way to communicate. And if two sets of people can do that, then guess what? It's a win-win, as they say.
Yeah, I was just thinking about all the different regional dialects in America, let alone from space. Trying to keep track of all of them. I believe, Natalie, you've put together a book of some of those things?
I have a co-authored book called American English, Dialects and Variations, for people who would like to learn more about that. And again, I have an audio-video course called English in America, A Linguistic History, in which I talk about, well, okay, we have British English on one side of the Atlantic, we have American English on the other. How did they get to be so different? Where did American English come from? Where did American English is come from? Because you're right, there are a number of different dialects. And yeah, sometimes it seems kind of crazy to be talking about how we're going to communicate with creatures from other planets and other solar systems when it's often very difficult even to understand somebody from somewhere else in the U.S., for example. And for that matter, sometimes it's very difficult even to communicate accurately and adequately with, I don't know, people that you see every day and live with, right? I mean, we all have misunderstandings with people that we feel like we're very close to, and we realize we're just hearing each other differently or maybe misinterpreting what somebody, even who's speaking the same language and dialect,
wait,
we know very
what well. Do you mean by that?
I was just sitting here thinking that me and Fitz are both from Pennsylvania, and sometimes we're speaking completely different languages.
Wait, what do you mean by that?
Well, we're on the opposite sides of the state, and there's a whole different dialect.
Oh, you're right. There's, linguists have for years have studied the well, they call it really southeastern Pennsylvania dialect region, but there's also the western Pennsylvania dialect region. And they are different in many ways. It's English, and people can basically understand each other, but there are definitely differences in pronunciations and the lexicon. And again, this is more Natalie's field. I can scratch the surface of it in a forensic linguistic analysis, but I would sometimes turn to Natalie if I want to, deep into a rabbit hole somewhere about someone's very nuanced feature and how they write or pronounce a certain word. But it can tell a whole lot about them, and certainly the roots of their upbringing and where they learned their particular dialect.
Natalie, is it common, like, because we were just talking about Western Pennsylvania, for like Pittsburgh to have its own, and then the outlying region to have its own, or is this, how does that work across the country?
Pittsburgh is pretty unique because it has an extremely well-defined but extremely geographically limited dialect. So you guys are really lucky because you have a very distinctive dialect that's very confined to a specific area and very unique to you. Only people from Pittsburgh say yins for, you plural, so y'all type of thing. Only people from Pittsburgh say gum band, where the rest of us say rubber band. So that's good. So, you have a very strong linguistic and dialect identity. Speaking in terms of forensic linguistics, language evidence, if you're from Pittsburgh and you're going to try to commit a crime and be anonymous and leave maybe an anonymous phone call or a ransom note or something like this, you might accidentally give yourself away, because you have very distinctive dialect features that in other parts of the U.S. probably not necessarily as readily recognizable. In the South, yeah, that's obviously its own very distinctive dialect. So Pittsburgh is one of the more unique ones. You should be proud of that.
We try to be.
And Jim, just to follow,
yeah, go ahead.
To follow up on that a little bit, you asked about, how are regions constricted or restricted, and a lot of times it has to do with rivers and mountain ranges. It's as simple as that. And that can be the separating line of a dialect region or sub-dialect region in any country, but certainly in the U.S. And certainly there are rivers in Pittsburgh, and there's vast space between Pittsburgh and Harrisburg and certainly Philly. So all those things play in terms of how dialects originate and how they sort of become locked in and localized over decades and even centuries for that matter.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm sitting here thinking, as I have my phone handy, how does the quote-unquote tech speak change all of this? I'm sure this is frustrating to you, because you both, actually, as everything gets shorter, it narrows the margin of error, so to speak, right?
Well, you'd actually be surprised. So linguists have done things such as, let's look at tweets that people tweet from all over the U.S., and yeah, it's probably going to be all pretty homogenous, and we won't be able to tell where anybody's from anymore, right? But it turns out that actually regional dialect differences actually do perpetuate in social media space, in text, in tweets, and things like that. So that's very interesting. And also studies of things such as, do people who text other people, can you tell who's doing it? Or maybe somebody kidnapped you, stole your phone, and they're pretending to be you, something like this. Can we tell as a linguist? And actually, you can. People actually, believe it or not, even in short little texts, have their own distinctive style of texting, which is very fascinating. You wouldn't think that would happen, but it does. So Fitz is right when he says that geographic barriers have a lot to do with why there are different dialects, why different individuals speak differently. But a lot of it is also your group identity and your personal sense of identity. And that's why many of us have the same type of phone, use the same technology, but we develop distinctive styles with our social group and even our, myself as an individual, because we like to be distinguished by our language, among other ways of distinguishing ourselves, of setting ourselves apart.
See, I'm just mind blown that you can still tell the difference because sometimes I can't understand what people are typing me, or they can't understand what I'm typing them, let's be honest.
And Jim, if I could add here, I'm not sure of too many cases in the U.S. where text messaging played into the solving of a homicide case, but I know of several, maybe even up to half a dozen in the U.K., where there were kidnappings, there were murders, and bad things happened, where, in fact, the killer, like Natalie inferred here, where the killer actually took the victim's phone and started like texting people in an attempt to, assure them that the victim was okay and alive, and oh, I'm not going to be home for a few days, or I'm running away, and it makes it look like the victim is fine when actually, in reality, the victim's already been murdered. And it took some forensic linguists in the UK to actually look at these text messages, these suspect text messages, the real text messages of the victim when she was still alive, and of course, prior text messaging of the offender. And they piece all those together, and they make it very clear the victim did not send these text messages, and the offender did. And nothing to do with time of death or anything like that, strictly through a language analysis perspective that they could build a case, and a few of them were arrested and jailed and convicted, and the linguistic evidence held up in court. So text messages, even in the minimal amount of characters, 140, 280, whatever it is now, there's enough linguistic evidence in there that a good forensic linguist can in fact determine much about it, and certainly compare them to others and determine the frequency of comparativeness between them, and cases can be solved, like I said.
Just amazing. Okay, so I asked Jim this the last time, Natalie, but since you're the first time here, what in the world got you originally interested in this?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I've grown up always interested in languages. In undergrad school, I was an English literature major, and I took courses in different languages, Spanish, German, etc., and that led me eventually to discover that there was a field called linguistics, which is, again, the study of human languages, and more broad than studying, a different language or a couple of different languages. So just a natural interest, really, in the vast variety of languages that there are in the world. And Sid said a little while ago, the aliens come and they can understand our human language. Well, he's going to have to contend with 6,000-plus human languages in the world, and that's pretty amazing. And then within each of those languages, all the different dialect variations, as you pointed out, that exist. So that's fascinating. Sometimes I wonder, well, how come everybody in the world isn't interested in this area of study? Because it's just so, incredibly interesting, and so much you can delve into and get out of it. It's such a window into who we are, as Fitz and I were both talking about, whether you're going to look at that from the perspective of criminal investigation or scientific study, or you just want to understand the person that you hang out with all the time and learn to better communicate with them. So it's just fascinating.
I'm going to back you up for just a second. You said 6,000 different languages. Is that like including dead ones, or is that all active around the world currently?
Well, that's a very ballpark number, because the number of human languages that there are in the world depends exactly where you draw your dividing lines between language and dialect. So if you think about, for example, somebody with a really, for me, so I can actually, even though I'm a professional language studier or a professional linguist, I can sometimes barely understand somebody who has a strong Scottish English accent. And so you sometimes wonder, well, where's the line between when does that get to be a different language? But there are actually currently in the world approximately 6,000 different languages, which is amazing. You wouldn't think that, but there are.
And Jim, there are languages dying every day, or certainly dialects of languages dying every day. And there are linguists that they're full-time. Not everybody, teaches necessarily full-time or is a forensic linguist. There's so many different aspects of linguistics, and some of them, some of these linguists, their job is to record these languages that are dying. There's not a whole lot, a linguist could do, or even society could do, to keep a language alive and keep people talking, but they at least try that, and they certainly want to try to record these languages so 50 or 100 years from now, at least there'll be some record of that. And I think, Natalie, a few linguists involved in that type of work, right?
Oh, yeah, linguists are definitely involved in that. So there used to be hundreds of languages in what's now the United States, for example, and most of those were eradicated or all but eradicated, and linguists do work with smaller languages or with languages that are otherwise in danger of going into extinction, and as Fitz said, at least to get a record of them if they are to disappear, and sometimes work to build teaching materials to help generate interest among kids in learning the language. If your kids don't speak your language is going to go away, so that's crucial. So yeah, that's right. So there are 6,000-ish languages right now, but it's predicted that by the end of the 21st century, there will be probably no more than 3,000. So that's a lot of language loss going on every day in the world.
That is a lot. That's,
mm-hmm.
Wow. I mean, I guess as the world gets smaller, so to speak, I can just see that trend continuing to decrease, too.
Yeah, that's part of it. But again, as I've already mentioned a couple of times, the other side of the coin is our individual and cultural languages are very important to us. And interestingly, at the same time the languages go away, we all still really value our linguistic, our dialect and language differences. And we do actually work to keep them alive sometimes, especially when we encounter people who have different languages or dialects. We work even harder to keep our own dialect distinctive.
Give me a real quick anecdote here. I was in Ireland in the late 70s, and it was just around the time that the Gaelic language was sort of dying out, and there were so few people speaking it. But to the Irish government's credit, and I'm sure there were linguists involved and other people within the country, they've worked really hard to bring the Gaelic language back into the school systems, and now there are young children. They may or may not be fluent in the language, but they certainly have a familiarity with it. I know many of the street signs and the town signs are listed in traditional, I guess, British English, if you will, or traditional spelling, but also in Gaelic, and I found that to be very refreshing when I heard that. So there's, you know, a Western country that had its own language for many, well, centuries and beyond, slowly dying out with the influx of probably British English, maybe some American English, but here there are people with enough foresight, including linguists, to do their best to keep that language alive. So that's just one example in that country, and I know there's other examples around the world.
Well, I was just thinking about French in Canada while we're sitting here, and how that's probably going to be on that list of things that are going to slowly disappear.
That's exactly right. Yeah, speaking French in Canada is becoming increasingly rare, and English has really is taking over. There are, you know, lots of efforts to preserve French in Canada. There are government mandates to keep French alive, but it takes so much to keep a language alive in the force of a big world language that people see as having economic advantage, as having prestige, as having, you know, cultural capital. So it's really tough.
Jim, another anecdote from my world travels. I've been fortunate enough through the FBI and even since then to travel a bit around the world. People, I think, in the U.S. don't realize as much how political a language can be within a country, or certainly even a dialect. All right, so someone's from New England, doesn't pronounce their R's. It's really no big deal. You still talk. You'll have a beer with them. You know, someone in the South says y'all instead of you. No big deal. I remember being in Spain about 10 years ago, and I traveled to the north in the area of Santiago and that part of the country. And I noticed they had some signs for the city. One of the cities there is Coruña, C-O-R-U-N-A. And how the signs were listed, they had the article in front of it, a Coruña. And I noticed driving through the city, there was spray paint where somebody climbed a pole and sprayed out the A in front of Coruña. And I, after seeing like five or six signs, I said to my Spanish friend who was driving me around, I said, who climbs poles to cross out a letter in front of the name of your city? He goes, oh boy, that's a big political issue here, because Spain is really, what, Natalie, like five, I mean, we all say they speak Spanish there, but Spaniards considered what they speak, Castilian, Catalan, is it, and others, they consider them separate languages, and it's very political, goes back to the days of Franco and... And so, again, we don't really have that language issue in this country. Natalie?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, if we Americans tend to think, well, one country, one language, but that's absolutely not true. Well, in the U.S. alone, there are many, many languages spoken by everybody who's in the U.S. And so it's, yeah, quite a myth and a misunderstanding. I think, well, it's Spain, so they speak Spanish. Well, it's France, so they speak French. Well, it's the U.S., so they speak English. Not true at all. There's so much language diversity within and across every country. And, yeah, sometimes what gets proclaimed as an official or national language might just be one of numerous languages that are spoken in a country. And they can be very contentious, as Fitz was pointing out, absolutely.
And what a lot of people don't know is there is no official or national language of the U.S. I mean, nothing on paper, nothing recognized, of course, in the Constitution or any amendment. So, and some people have argued that for years, well, it should be English, whatever, but it's not.
There you go. Bringing my brain right to a stop because I was, and then you just say that and it just, again, I'm sitting here thinking about multiple different things, but one thing that this keeps coming back around is there an area of America that is more like nondescript? Because we have the, like you said, Boston and Pittsburgh and in the South, and I'm sure out West they have their own. Is it the heartland that would be, well, I guess Texas has their own. I'm just trying to find the quote-unquote most bland English in America.
That's a really good question, and you're right. A lot of people would say, oh, somewhere in the heartland, maybe Ohio, maybe, or I don't know, Great Lakes region, Michigan, something like that. But it turns out that everywhere in any country has their own unique dialect, their own way of speaking the language that they speak. So the idea of, well, is there sort of a bland American English or a typical or general non-accented American English? Not really. Not one that's geographically defined per se. So we might think about, well, there are sort of more generic, less noticeable styles that we use in particular context, more formal context, that kind of thing in writing. But in typical everyday life, anywhere you go, people are going to have a unique way of using a language. We tend to notice some of them more than others. We all, if I ask anybody, a class of mine or something like this, what are the dialects of the U.S., everybody immediately says, oh, Southern. So we all recognize that one. We all know it. We can probably imitate some features of it. And the other ones might be more subtle, but they're still there. So that's a great question, though.
Thanks. Because these random things good for my mind. Because obviously, I'm guessing Southern is probably, as you were saying, you ask your students, probably the most pronounced, most obvious one for everybody to pick up.
Oh, yeah, it is. And even as you were pointing out, though, within the South, Texas South is different from, Mountain South or Coastal South or something like this. So that's another complication that we would enter into is we can't just draw a big line and say all of the U.S. Southeast is one dialect. So different parts, different subregions have different dialects, and then even different communities within a region, and even different individuals develop their own unique ways of speaking, which is part of what keeps people who do forensic linguistics like Fitz and me in business.
That's right. Spoken word and written word.
Well, I think criminals keep you in business, but solving the case is what...
That's right.
So let's shift gears out of language for a minute. Let's get into the art of entertainment, so to speak. I don't even know where I want to go with this. The reality versus what you guys do on a day-in-and-day basis versus what we see on TV, I guess is where I want to go. Because I obviously know I'm not stupid enough to believe that everything gets solved happily, cleanly, and within an hour. Because you were mentioning, I heard you doing an interview, Fitz, about the anthrax. That took a couple of years, if I recall correctly from that interview.
Oh, that's a real sore subject with me. I mean, I have no problem talking about it with you, but before more recent times in the Bureau, in terms of some political things going on, that was the one case that really stuck in my craw, because there were me and a few other profilers were telling then-Director Mueller and his people working the anthrax case, no, you've got the wrong guy. I won't even mention the wrong guy's name on your show here, but But they followed this guy around, never arrested him, but they drained a lake near his house and searched his house and all his computers, whatever. And we just kept saying, this is the wrong guy, the wrong guy. And finally, they found out it wasn't. He sued the government. He's a wealthy man now, and quite frankly, he probably deserves that. But then eventually, it was a year after I retired, I helped the new task force was formed, and they were focusing elsewhere. I was there at the beginning stages of this new task force, and eventually in 2008, the summer of 2008, an individual was identified, and as soon as his lawyers were contacted, he wound up killing himself. So they never got a confession out of him, but there's no doubt he was the anthrax guy. And from 2001, right after 9/11 attacks, this guy came out and he was killing people for his own purposes, basically to get his vaccine that he sort of invented or at least was developing, you know, out into the mainstream market. And that's why he decided to send anthrax through the mail. And we knew there was some personal agenda behind it. It wasn't a terrorist attack. By definition, and eventually that's what it turned out to be. So, yeah, that was a tough case back then. But there was a language element to it. There were several different letters that accompanied those anthrax letters, the envelopes, I should say. And I think I had about 39 words total. And the bosses at the FBI said, Fitzgerald, I want you to do all these media interviews, and I know you're involved in this linguistic stuff. They probably pronounced it like you too, Jim, in the beginning. I said, no, boss, it's linguistics. It's not an Italian meal. It's a study of language. And I had to basically do my best in the media to tell them about these two letters with about 39 words total with, you know, DEFTA, America, praise Allah, and just a few other things. DEFTA Israel, too, was how each letter ended. I did my best, and in that case, I asked to do some more work with linguistic analysis. I wanted to look at the known writings of all the scientists they had at USAMARID, which is a U.S. Army military research facility of some sort. The acronym's off a little bit there. But they said, no, we know you had success in the Unabomb case, but we don't need this kind of work here. We know who it is. It's this guy, blank, blank. But they were wrong, and I never did get a chance to do any real strong linguistic analysis in that case. But that's coming up in my next book. I'll spend a chapter, Jim, talking about that case and, quite frankly, what the FBI initially did wrong under some poor management, but they eventually got it right. And I firmly believe that the correct guy was arrested, identified in 2008. He was never arrested because he chose to take the easy way out and kill himself.
Is that the smallest size sample that you have had to work with and actually had success?
Meaning in the anthrax case?
Yeah, 39 words. I mean, that's. I mean, some of those are.
I'm not saying to anybody that linguistics cracked the case. There was another letter sent to the town of Quantico police. Not so many know about this. This will be in my fourth book, which actually matched up in a few different areas. Again, we're talking about written language here, to the anthrax letters, including a odd usage of the demonstrative pronoun that. So, but again, linguistics, I wasn't really allowed to get into this case. But now that you ask me, there's a couple cases I've worked where there was really like nothing of value in like several pages or even several paragraphs. But Natalie, why don't we talk about the one case I worked in back where the designer helped us solve the case. And it was a private case I worked only a few years ago, meaning it wasn't the police involved. But real quick here, Jim, there was a few threatening type things, a few letters. It was a boyfriend-girlfriend thing. I won't mention any names or even states. But at some point, the female was writing letters to her ex-boyfriend, and they were anonymous. And she was being snarky in it and wrote something about the fashion designer who makes purses, shoes, other clothes, Michael Kors, and she spelled Michael fine, but then she spelled Kors, K-O-H-R-S. And I went through that a few times, and to me, no significance there. I had some other linguistic features, and I just happened to show the letter to Natalie, and why don't you take over, Natalie, at that point?
I don't remember the details of the case, but I remember that I immediately looked at it, and I said, no, there's definitely something that's very off with this letter, because that's not how you spell the designer's name. And people who don't typically go out and buy handbags and things like that for themselves, which I don't think Fitz does, didn't necessarily pick up on that, but I happened to kind of be a fan of this designer, and I noticed it, and he was able to use that to link, I believe, anonymous writings with writings of known authorship when there weren't really many other clues. And in this case, it wasn't because I was an expert in linguistics that I noticed it, but because I happened to be familiar with what was being written about and that was a misspelling. And so, yeah, it's hard to sometimes, yeah, where you get a valuable clue from can just be a little bit happenstance, really, in a way. So,
and for your listeners who maybe don't buy Michael Kors purses or handbags or whatever, it is spelled K-O-R-S. And I think I eventually would have searched that online. Almost every proper noun I search when I work a case online to make sure I have it right. But just, you know, though I was only in day two, there was no real deadline on this case. I just, look at this letter, Natalie. We share our cases sometimes. And she goes, well, one thing is this person doesn't spell the designer's name right. I said, oh, yeah, you're correct. And I had the client search all his ex-girlfriend's text messages, and he went back like a whole year. And sure enough, she talked about buying herself a new Michael Kors purse, K-O-H-R-S. Bingo. Linguistically speaking, that's your smoking gun. And case solved. And I told the client, and next thing you know, the girlfriend admitted to writing the letters, and case was over. And whatever they were trying to do, Natalie and I'll speak for myself, but I think Natalie's the same way. We don't really like to know details of the cases we're working, even criminal cases. The less I know as a linguist, the better. That way I'm objective. I'm just looking at the four corners of a certain document. Now, I knew all about the Unabomber case. I couldn't help but know that back in the mid-90s. I wasn't even a linguist then. But I certainly knew all about the bombings, the different victims, different locations, different types of bombing devices, the detonators, the charge, and the explosive material, whatever. But nowadays, if it's a private sector case or something that's not big in the news, I always say the less I know, the better. And if I'm being cross-examined on the stand, a month or a year later, it's like, I don't even know who's suing who here. All I know is here's the language involved in the case, and here's what I believe is the actual author of these particular anonymous letters, and that seemed to work pretty good for us.
So I promised to get you guys off here in a couple minutes, so I'm going to do that. But first, I got the last question here for you. So you can give me an answer and then give me a little brief why, and then we'll wrap, get some promos and all that fun stuff done. What's your favorite language and or dialect?
Oh, that's easy for me. It's English and Philly dialect, because that's what where I grew up and speak. But I certainly respect others and, all around the world. I speak very little. If I'm in Spain for a week, I can pick up on basic food orderings, whatever. So I'd say my second favorite language is Spanish. I had like 5 years of it between high school and college. And, of course, there's different dialects of it. Growing up in Philly, it was mostly Puerto Rican Spanish I heard as a kid. Now you may hear more Mexican-type Spanish. And I'll just even though I'm a linguist and I certainly have a broad understanding of the science of language and the theory behind it, I'll stick what's what works best for me. Now, Natalie's going to give a much more esoteric answer here, right?
No, not at all. I think all languages and all dialects are absolutely amazing and fascinating in terms of how they're structured and what they can tell us about the people who speak them. But because I'm such a big fan of Fitz's, I'm also going to have to go with Philadelphia English as my favorite language and dialect, because he's paying me to say that.
I'm going to give her a scotch and water.
Congratulations to your Eagles, by the way. I don't know if I mentioned that the last... no, obviously it wasn't the last time you were on, because it was November or so when you were on Fitz, by the way.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I was rooting for them in South Philly that night.
So...
it was a fun...
Fitz, you've got the Center to the Journey of the Mind that's available at bookstores everywhere, I'm assuming?
Some bookstores. It's a three-part memoir series I wrote for my youth in Philadelphia. Some language things in there. The second book, they're all titled A Journey to the Center of the Mind. Book one, the coming of age years, growing up as a kid, getting in trouble, doing some good things, hanging out with future killers and naked people in the woods. I was a young kid and approached by some bizarre guy. I got out of it in one piece, and went off to Penn State and doing some crazy things there, but eventually graduating the police academy. Book two is in my 11 years of my time as a Ben Salem, Pennsylvania police officer. That's the northern suburbs of Philly. I was a regular officer, then detective, then sergeant, and a lot of cops and robber stuff, gunplay, car chases, some politics in the middle, but then it charts my way to the FBI near the end. And book three is the first 10 years of my FBI career. And the book title, of course, is A Journey to the Center of the Mind. And I was a Jules Verne fan, by the way, his Journey to the Center of the Earth. So that's where the title came from. Natalie actually helped me pick a title for the book, too. And book four will be out sometime in late 19, and that'll finish up my FBI career. And we'll talk about some stuff afterwards, my work on Criminal Minds and Manhunt Unabomber and all those kind of things.
And we'll have you back. I'll have you back to talk about it and promote it and all that fun stuff.
Okay.
Unless you don't want to come back on. Just kidding.
So far, Jim, I'll come back on. Just don't ruin it in the next 5 minutes.
Well, all I've got to do is ask Natalie where she could find the video. We could find the video. Obviously, she knows where she could find it. I just might have ruined it.
No, you didn't. No, it's English in America, A Linguistic History. It's available through the Great Courses. So that's the Great Courses. It's produced by a company called The Teaching Company. You can just Google the name of the course. You can just look up the Great Courses. Probably a lot of your listeners are already subscribers to the Great Courses. So it's available that way. And again, I also have a book called American English, Dialects and Variation, if anybody's interested in getting into linguistic nitty-gritty about all the dialects of American English.
Well, I want to thank you first, Natalie, for coming on and joining us. It's been a great pleasure. And also, I want to thank Fitz for having us get connected. And I want to wish you both a good evening.
Sounds good, Jim. Let's do it again sometime.
Oh, we will. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye. And that's Dr. Natalie Schilling and James Fitzgerald, the FBI profiler. Wow. I mean, they love studying me. They probably have a notebook on me of the dialect that I transform and put out there. Phone line is open if you want to call in and talk about any of the stuff you just heard. Dialect, space alien dialect, anything you want to talk about. If not, I'm happy to report that, let's talk about this. For the main moments here that we have left, we've got a few moments left. Like I said, the number is open, 234-738-2552. If you got me on Skype, you can obviously ding me that way, or if you want to send a message, you can send a message. Okay, so I'm not exactly sure how I want to get into this, but we're going to get into it, because I think this is pretty fun. It's hot. It's summertime. People are going and coming, and let's be honest. We're all thinking about vacation, or all taking vacation, or hopefully somewhere in that course. Now, obviously, I've heard from a great number of people through the years that they've downloaded bunches of shows and took them on the road and listened to them. And that's great. I actually enjoy hearing that. So if you're one of those people who are packing up the RV and or packing up the family car and taking the Maori report with you, great. Please tell me, because I enjoy hearing those stories. Or if you're working out at the gym or whatever you're doing, again, I like hearing it because it's great hearing where people listen. Now, I know a lot of people listen. And a lot of people will never say a word to me. And that's fine. But if you want to drop me an email, I'll reply back to you. It's not rocket science. Or a tweet or a Facebook message or I don't know if anybody uses Google+, but it's there. Great. LinkedIn's growing all the time, too. But here's the thing. Here's where it gets tricky. Significantly tricky for me. It's summertime. People are out of their minds, out traveling, not home, not in their normal routine. So how do we, as I put it back to you, How do we keep this train going? Because, in all honesty, I can do so much, right? I can sit here and produce a show high in the video. Audio feeds, podcasts. I can bombard you with tweets 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. A couple hundred a day. But how do we, meaning you as a listener, put this show forward? Do you share it? Do you tell people? No, I'm not banging anybody here. I'm just trying to encourage you to do some things. Because here, let's put it out there. I got another invite from another radio show host to join their site. And let me tell you, I like this person, I like their show. But I'm not paying $6.99 a month to join their show. I don't want to do that. And the best way for me to prevent having to do that is for the show to keep growing. Now, that sounds counterintuitive, right? Because as more listeners happen, more costs happen, right? Well, yes, to a point. But at this point, I have a range that I can still succeed to with the current model. The server company tells me I can get X number of downloads a day without any problem, without any adjustments, without anything. And let me tell you, the number they brought me back, if I could hit that number, I would gladly upgrade and gladly pay to keep the level of freeness out there. Because not only would I wouldn't have to pay for it, because an advertiser would step in and say, whoa. And that's all it's going to take, is somebody saying, whoa. Now let's rewind a little bit. Am I sitting here saying the show is suffering because of all these branding changes I've made? Not in the least. Slowly, we're starting to see the sift out that I thought we were going to see more organically happening. It's happening. My problem is, I don't see it as fast as I think I should see it. But it's happening. My problem is, I'm impatient. I don't understand why it's not sweeping the nation, 100 million downloads a year, da-da-da-da-da. I am greedy and impatient like that. Let's be honest. Who isn't, right? So, how are you, as a partner in this process? I'm going to deputize everybody listening to this podcast. Live listeners, podcast listeners, YouTube viewers. Right, the YouTube has gotten better. It's live video. Big shadow right now on my face because I'm talking with my hand up. That's got better. The podcast has got better. The ability to share click clips with your friends has gotten better. Everything is better. And the catch is, I'm giving it all to you. While other shows out there are charging $4, $5, $6, $7, $8, and yes, $10 a month. Did you just hear me? $10 a month for their content. Now, obviously, I could board it all up and quit giving stuff away. What's the point of that? I'm giving you the best stuff I can get. I'm giving you Roger Stone. I'm giving you George Torrey. I'm giving you Jim Fitzgerald. Giving it to you. Now, here's the catch. I want you to pay it forward and give it to somebody else. That's what I want. Give it to somebody else. Encourage somebody who hasn't listened to listen to. Tonight's show, far from paranormal, far from alternative, far from conspiracy. Legitimate, smart people talking. Right? Can we agree on that? So pay it forward. Send a message. I know I heard this at one time. I don't want the blowback from sharing a paranormal show from some of the people in my Facebook list. Well, don't share it publicly then. We all have those friends. right, who aren't into the paranormal. A, I don't care anymore. They're just along for the ride. But B, I understand that you don't want them to be in your basket because you're demon-worshipping and whatever else. Trust me. I get it. I understand. Doesn't mean everybody knows their friends and their Facebook, right? Right. Not exactly. Okay. So find a few of them. Find a few of those people that just add you because they add you and start sending them show links. Maybe they'll delete you. Maybe they'll become good friends. That is the hope. That's what I need. Hey, if you want to write a big check, we can talk about who to write that check and where to send it. All right? I'm not stupid. Money fuels this thing. But more importantly, a lot more importantly, is that connection. Because, yes, everybody sees all the tweets go by. A lot of people do. And very few select people take the time to read them. Now, you send a message to somebody, that is a direct recommendation. Saying, hey, I want you to check this out. And that's the important thing. This is the old-fashioned way. This is how we take the world. It's not retweets. Well, I love them, and you can do them all day, every day. It's that one-on-one connection that the world seems to be losing. But we're not going to lose that here. We are going to take this one at a time, one show at a time, one week at a time, one day at a time. Because we all know that's how this has to go. So hey, if tonight's show wasn't what you want to share with somebody, fine. Go find one that you do. There's 250-ish shows that you can go through and listen to and find one that you can share with somebody. And if you can't find one out of those 250 shows to share with somebody, why are you still listening? Seriously, why can't you share it? You value the time. You put an hour into it. Share it with somebody else. That is the key to this success. Make sense, everybody? All right, yeah. Hopefully I'm not speaking out of turn here. Hopefully I haven't lost a lot of people. And I probably did. Probably angered a lot of people. Because, you know, that's what I do here. Anger a lot of people. No, I hope not. Now, here's the next thing. You ready for this? This is where this gets tricky. As it goes, we have to not only keep motivated. I have to keep motivated. Why do I have to keep motivated? I mean, what's next? Where's success? Come on. There have been a lot of things, a lot of great things said. And I could just sit here and roll up and plug in and quote-unquote mail it in. I mean, I've heard it from a number of people that I host the top live paranormal show on the internet. And that's not it. Can I do it every night? Can I do it every Tuesday? Can I do it every week? Can I do it 52 weeks a year? Can I do it multiple years in a row? Now that is my goal. Can I string this quality together over a term? I hope so. I hope you all are understanding what I'm saying to you. Because some people don't get it. I don't know how to explain it to them, so I'm going to try. And trust me, we're getting back to there's going to be a lot of paranormal. There's going to be a lot of conspiracy. There's going to be a lot of topical stuff. That's what the show is. It's all over the place. Excuse me. And the goal is to keep flowing and keep everybody interested as we go. So what I call tonight, very topical show tonight. That's what tonight was, topical. Wasn't trending, for sure. Last week was trending with the Space Force show. Next week, we're got a very paranormal guest on. I've paid attention. I'm trying to pay attention to the details so you can get each one of these categories every so often. That's my goal. My goal is to live up to that header up there on top of the website. Not just put words up there just because the SEO thing should factor in. No. That's the driving force of this program. I had a listener today ask me what I talk about. Now, I look at that list and I have a hard time describing my booking process to anybody. And it's not a trade secret. It's not that I don't want to tell people. It's 90% gut. There are a few rules that I have, but they're like two. After that, it becomes a reading bio, reading website. Very rarely does it include listening to them do another show. I did listen to a clip with Fitz this afternoon, and him and Natalie, just so I could see how how they interacted and how they flowed together. That way I wasn't talking over top of them, but I only listened for about 7 minutes. It wasn't a great trying to get into the great topics of the day. I love the chords of music. I just have to remember they're coming. Oh, boy. It seems like I don't know. I got to get this settled, Duck Pond. I don't know exactly what's going to happen. But I don't like this situation. I know that much. Next week it'll be better. If this isn't the answer, I will have a better answer. This chat room is just bumming me out. I missed the old Duck Pond that worked. I mean, this is working, but it's not working as well as it should. Bums me out. Okay, open challenge time. For those of you who are... I've asked a few people, Germantown Runner and some other fine folks. Nobody's been able to come up with a good answer, so we're going to throw it out to you, all of my listeners. Send me an email. Don't send it publicly, because I want to be able to give you credit correctly after it gets vetted and stuff. I need the quote-unquote tagline for me, so I can be introduced as not just Jim Mallard, host of the Mallard Report. That's something I don't know. There needs to be a line in there.
Views and opinions expressed on the Mallard Report are those of the host and participants. For past shows, social media links, and so much more, visit Mallard.com, MallIard.com. And thanks for listening.